Welcome to the Product Makers Podcast, where we interview and have open conversations with product makers and leaders from both large enterprises and startups about their experiences in growing successful products, teams, and companies around the world. I'm your host, Adam Davis, here at Product Board. Today, my guest is Dan Olson. Dan Olson is a product management trainer, consultant, and speaker. Dan wrote the best-selling product management book, The Lean Product Playbook. And through his talks and interactive training workshops, Dan helps companies build great products and strong teams around the world. Some of his clients include Google, Facebook, Amazon, Box, Uber, and Walmart. He's also the founder of a 12,000-member Lean Product Meetup community. In today's episode, we dive into the main challenges product makers face when working in enterprise and B2B companies. Given Dan's experience, I was really interested in his insight on these topics. So today, we discuss navigating the pressure product teams face from stakeholders such as sales teams and the tactics you can use to build strong partnerships and quality products. We dig into why MVP is one of the most debated topics in product development. That's a really good conversation. And then Dan provides his experience on a simple way to approach product planning and creating roadmaps. Thanks for listening and enjoy today's podcast. All right. Awesome. Dan, well, welcome to the podcast. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Adam. How are you doing?
I'm not too bad here. It was a sunny day in London, which is a nice welcome change as we go into awesome. Winter.
Let's keep the sun going for Mind the Product in 2 weeks. I would love to have a sunny London trip. That would be awesome.
Yeah, it is coming up in 2 weeks. And I was just going to say, what's keeping you busy at the moment? We were probably getting ready for all the conference season.
Yes, we were just joking about how everybody loves to have their events in October. There's so many products. On the one hand, I'm super psyched because we're back in person, which is great. I've been missing seeing all the product people at all the conferences around the world. So I'm super excited. But yes, preparing my workshops and talks for those, getting ready for those trips, but I'm super excited.
Awesome. And which ones have you got lined up at the moment?
Industry. I'm leaving Sunday for industry. I'm excited. And I'll see you in Product Board there. So that'd be great. And, several hundreds of our closest product friends. So it's always fun to get together. It's a great conference. And then the week after that, I'm actually hosting my own. There's an event that I co-organized called Product Leader Summit here in Silicon Valley, which also has been virtual. And so we're excited to bring it back in person. And then the week after that, I'll be out Mind the Product London. So yeah.
A lot of flying. Yeah. We keeping busy.
Yes. Yes, yes. Yeah.
Brilliant. All right. Well, here we've got an awesome episode and kind of lineup of what we're going to talk about today, especially really focusing on enterprise companies. But what I do with all our guests before we get started, we do a bit of a quick round so that listeners get to know you a little bit more if they don't know.
Yeah.
Into the meaty bits. So the questions aren't too challenging, but I'll rattle through them and then we can jump into it. Does that sound good?
Sure.
Awesome. All right. I ask everyone this. What's your favorite beverage? Now, it can be anything.
Yeah. And I wasn't sure about this, but, I was like, okay, what I drink the most is probably water. But what I most enjoy, when I moved out to California, I was more of a beer person. But when you live in Northern California, eventually you kind of get drawn into wine. And so I like Pinot Noir. And my favorite place where they make Pinot Noir that I like is San Jose Island, down by Carmel Valley. So if I had to pick, a favorite beverage, that would probably be it for an out with dinner or something.
Beautiful. Love it. Yeah, there's a lot of good wine, Pinot Noir in New Zealand as well. All right. Next one. What is your favorite travel destination and why?
Yeah, this is a tough one. At first, I was thinking vacation stuff, and I was thinking Hawaii because it's close to us and we always have fun there. But honestly, if I have a chance, I go back to Spain every time because I'm half Spanish. My mom was from Spain, and I grew up in Spain for 8 years. So it's kind of like going back home when I go. So, I grew up in southern Spain, and this last summer, I had a chance to check out some of northern Spain. San Sebastian was gorgeous. I mean, everybody that goes there says it's amazing, and the food is great. So I got to check that out, but there's still plenty of places in Spain to check out. So that's my favorite place to go.
All right. What's your favorite product at the moment? Can be anything.
Yeah, this is always fun to, as a product person, it's tough. You're pretty harsh on products, but the one that I like the most is a Whoop. So Whoop is a heart rate monitor that you wear on your wrist, right? And it, one of the beauties of it, I love the design. There's no real UI. It's got a little LED light, but there's no screen, which is a good call from a design standpoint because then the battery life is much longer than an Apple Watch, for example, right? And so you just use a companion app. But basically, it tracks your heart rate all day. The main reason I use it is for sleep tracking, to kind of make sure I'm getting enough sleep, because if I don't, I definitely notice the impact. And, you know, some people into the whole quantified self, I don't go too far on that, but that's a way to kind of keep track of what's going on. And I just think they made some great progress. The other cool product design, I think their UI on their app is great.
Yeah.
One of the other popular hair trackers is the Oura Ring. And one of my friends, who's a serious athlete, I was with him the other day, and he had switched from the Whoop to the Oura Ring. I'm like, why'd you switch? He's like, I just kind of prefer this ring. I was like, well, let's pull up the app and compare the UI. And we pulled up the app, and like some of the insights I'm able to get from the Whoop graphs and charts, you just couldn't get, right? So at the end of the day, you're like, okay, it's gathering all this data. What do I do with this data? It really comes down to the insights that you get. And the visualizations, you can see kind of monthly changes over a 6-month period that really helps you see the trends of what's going on. It's kind of like the stock market. You can look at it every day, but you don't know what's going on. You want to zoom out a little bit.
Yeah.
And then the last thing is that the charger slips on. Actually, I have it right here. It slips on and off. So, you know, cool. You don't have to take the device off to charge it, which you do for an Apple Watch and for the Oura Ring. So it's just a lot of thought went into the design. And then business-wise, they were pretty smart. They went with a SaaS subscription. So it's not like a Fitbit where you pay once and then it's yours, because they're providing ongoing value. And they've actually rolled out a lot of additional features over time because they've got that SaaS subscription mindset. So,
all right, we've got two more questions. One thing you've changed recently and how you approach your work that's made a difference?
Yeah. I think you're probably looking for something different, but that biggest impact that I've had is, it took me a while. I don't know why I didn't do it sooner. I finally got a standing desk. You know, during the first 2 years of COVID, I was just sitting at my desk, you know, and I finally got a standing desk. And then the other thing that I did is I got this treadmill that goes, you can roll in and out from under the desk, not built in. I can tuck it under the bed if I want. And so I will, like, you know, every other day, I'll like walk like 5 miles while I'm doing email and browsing and doing work. So.
Yeah. Nice.
It's a great kind of time saver and health hack to be able to just get some walking in instead of just sitting there, you know, while I'm working.
Yeah, 100%. No, I love it. Like, we've actually spoken a few times about, don't love the word hack, but I don't know a better word, hack, in terms of how do you, you know, improve. But I've got a standing desk right now and it's made a massive difference. All right, final one. What's your advice to having a successful career? Quite a big one, but yeah, what would be
your advice? I think at a high level, you know, I was just reflecting on this the other day. I was talking to someone. It's like, just, you know, having a mindset of always being open to learning and learning, you know, I think that's really important, especially in product management. It's such a wide job. It's kind of a unique job in that, you know, no one reports to you, but you need to know about enough about development, enough about design, enough about customer research, enough about marketing, enough about business, you know. So you've got to be, you know, like a jack of all trades. And so I've always found in my career, learning, you know, investing time to learn, you know, not only my craft, but also the adjacent crafts of UX design, product development, marketing, business, all that has always paid off dividends and made me more effective. And so now you've got, you know, there's, you know, AI, are you learning about AI? Like, if you're a growth PM, are you learning about growth? Or if you're an analytics PM? So there's just, you know, there's that. Anyway, I think that when you invest in learning, you're investing in yourself and your career. And I think that the best PMs that I've met always have a curious mindset, and they're always looking to see what they can learn, which is why podcasts like this are great.
Yep. No, great advice and good reminder as well. Always be learning. Love it. All right, well, here, let's jump into it. So I think for our listeners, Dan, we've got a mixture of folks that work in startups, mid-sized companies, but also a lot of folks that work in large enterprise companies. And one of the things I'd love to pick your brain on based on your experience is just, what are some of the main challenges that product managers face in these larger enterprise companies? And like, yeah, what can they do differently to make, I don't know, better product decisions, improve the quality of their product outcomes? Yeah, I'd love to dig right into it.
Yeah. And just to, you know, just to clarify, like, so basically, you know, a lot of companies out there are direct to consumer, B2C. And a lot of the product management advice out there, a lot of the examples and stuff are B2C examples. Hey, look what Meta did. Look what, you know, Google did. So. And I have had a lot of enterprise B2B clients over time. I work with Box in the early days. I work with Medallia. And, you know, we were just talking about digital transformation. It seems like a lot of the digital transformation, the companies are going through that tend to be more enterprise and consumer. But there's not a lot of advice. So I'm actually giving a talk on this where I kind of curated the best advice. And there's a few challenges that you see, right? And one of them, we can start off with the first one, is that, you know, in a B2C company, there isn't usually like a big sales team presence, right? Like there might be an ad sales. If you have an advertising revenue model, there might be an ad sales team that's out talking to advertisers. But it's not like B2B where you've got this big important function sales that's got a seat at the table and maybe driving the bus at a lot of these enterprise companies, especially if you're a startup, right? If you're a startup and you're not cash flow positive, you've got to get revenue and you've got to get to the point where you've got to hit your revenue goals so you can raise your next round of funding and then so that you can eventually become profitable so that you can be a going concern and not have to worry about existing anymore, right? And so in the early days of startups, they're just happy to get any revenue they can, right? It's like, oh, cool, you just signed a $1,000 deal. Great, let's do it. You know, what do they want us to build? And so sales can, in a lot of these B2B companies, sales can be have a really loud voice and have a lot of power, right? And if you take a step back and think about it, companies, okay, what's the power balance between sales and like product management or engineering or finance, you know, what's that power balance? And a lot of enterprise companies, sales has, you know, is significantly more power. We can call it a sales-driven company. There are companies that are engineering-driven where engineering is kind of more calling the shots, right? Recently, I interacted with a company where they're very finance-driven. So like the CFO is like driving, influencing some of the product strategy because they have a certain goal. That's just their culture at their company, right? Mm-hmm. So anyway, it's interesting that you get that thing. And so in the extreme, if you're in product at a very sales-driven company, you may not be able to do some of the things that most product leaders or product mm-hmm. managers can do as far as really you're kind of driving or recommending what the product strategy should be. No, you're just doing whatever sales comes in and says, hey, I just signed a deal with big company X. We got to build these features. Here you go. And there's no real, you know, discussion mm-hmm. or question. It's like a fait accompli because they've already signed the contract, right? And so as a product manager in those kind of companies, you may feel like, gosh, I'm just like taking orders here and feeling I'm like a waiter taking orders to the kitchen to dev that, you know, is cooking up the product and I'm not adding tons of value as a product person. You know, of course, you're going to do the best job you can writing up the user stories and estimating and trying to make sure things are going on time, but you're focused. What ends up happening in those situations, you end up focusing on delivery mm-hmm. and versus discovery. And discovery is very important. I'm glad to see in the last several years, there's been more of an emphasis in the product blogs and videos and talks about discovery, because if PMs aren't doing discovery, chances are no one in the org is really doing discovery. And so if you're in a very sales-driven organization, you know, that can be tough. And so, you know, part of it is we actually here in the Bay Area, we have an interesting landmark that reminds me of this where, you know, if every single time some customer or prospect asks you for a feature, you say yes to it, you know, then I would argue you're not being strategic because, mm-hmm. you know, one of my favorite definitions comes from a Steve Jobs quote. He said, innovation means saying no. I rephrase it to say strategy means saying no. My favorite definition of strategy is saying no. If you're not saying no to some request, then you're not kind of bringing any unique vision to what your product's going to be. It's just kind of, it's like a random walk of what people are asking for. And if, you know, mm-hmm. one company's asking for a random feature that only they use and no one else uses, so the landmark that we have here in the Bay Area where I live is the Winchester Mystery House. And if you've ever been to, it's from the Winchester, the inventor of the Winchester rifle. He made a lot of money, he left the house to his heirs. And one of the people that owned the house just like went a little cuckoo. It was like building different things in the house. So the outside of the house looks fine. If you go inside though, it's like there are like stairs going to nowhere. They go to the ceiling. There's like, this room is all brick. There's like a window in the floor. And mm-hmm. that's kind of how I think about when you let your customers drive your product roadmap and strategy, you end up with this random assortment. And, you know, and it's not really a cohesive product. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the companies, I just came from a workshop where it's like, hey, we want to switch from being more of a custom software shop, services shop, to being more of a product. Like, you know, we want, instead of each of our clients having like a slightly customized version that we have to maintain over time, which is horrible from a tech debt and maintenance standpoint, we want to be a true product platform where everyone's using the same code base, right? Anyway, that's kind of the thing you want to get into, hopefully. And yeah, so, you know, and related to that is usually when sales comes to you, what they're asking you for is a solution or a feature. And so one of the problems here, this is something I've been talking about for a long time, is the difference between problem-based and solution-based. Mm-hmm. And what you want to do is try to get the conversation to be about real customer problems instead of just solutions. Because a number of times I've seen some small startup be so excited, they just signed a deal with IBM or Google. Oh, we just got this $1 million deal, cool. They're telling us what they want us to build. Let's go build it. And the number of times I've seen the company build what the big client wanted and then the big client not use it at all, it's sad, right? It's sad because they assume that the client knows what they want, but they didn't really know what they want because they were just specifying solutions and they didn't have a clear understanding of their customer problems, which again reinforces the importance of discovery. So you can have proper discovery discussions and say, yes, I hear you're asking for feature X. That's great. I'm not saying we won't build feature X. We may build feature X. But just to make sure we can build it the right way, let's just talk about what problem is going to solve for you. And you hopefully get into more of that problem-based discussion. Because again, if you just, the number of companies that just build the features that sales is telling them to build that don't succeed is high. Because it's a bit like ready, fire, aim. If you don't really know the problem, we're just building these things and no one really knows what problems we're trying to solve.
And Dan, what advice would you give to someone? So you've got, we talked a little bit about, you know, you've got this pressure, the sales team might be the largest voice in the room, especially like a large B2B SaaS. Like as a, if we played a scenario here, I'm a product manager, I'm working one of these teams, we're having to meet a lot of the needs of our sales team to kind of close these deals.
Right.
The features aren't really landing. Like, what would be your advice in terms of how can they start nudging that conversation to change a little bit to focus more on the problem?
That's a great question, and I'm happy to do that because I don't want to just point out a problem. I want to talk about how we can make it better. You know, the first is hopefully people in the company can see the pattern of we keep building what people ask for, but they're not using it and we're not getting renewal revenue from it, right? So it's clear, and the NPS is low, the usage is low. Like, there's enough signals, so part of it is like, as excited as we are that we closed the deal and got the contract and got the revenue, let's see if people are actually using this thing or not. And, you know, the reality is change is hard in org. Change management is hard. And I think that one of the biggest motivators that makes people actually look in the mirror and be honest with themselves is failure. So if we've spent all these eng cycles and resources and built these features and we can be honest with ourselves that they didn't achieve the goals that we had hoped, then that might create an opening for the product team to kind of try to change the discussion. So next time somebody comes with the, hey, you need to build, I know we built those 100 other features and they didn't work out, but this 101st feature, I'm telling you, this is the one. It's a bit of like this amnesia thing. It's like, ooh, we've been through this, it's like Groundhog Day. We've seen this habit where you can say, hey, yo, great. I understand that you think it's really important to build feature X. Can you help me understand like what customer problem that's going to solve, you know, just so we can build it. And I've coached product people on this. And look, sometimes it doesn't happen the first conversation. The salespeople don't get it. Like, I don't care about it. Let's just build that feature. Eventually, though, the second or third conversation, hopefully it gets through. This also brings up an important point, which is, you know, when sales is doing that, they are acting as what I call a proxy. They are trying to channel what they believe are customer requests, right? And when you look behind the curtain, you realize, gosh, a lot of times it may just be like a phrase in an email that they're going off of. They're kind of grasping at straws. Like, did they actually have an in-depth conversation with the user who's going to use the system? Or was it just some high-level stakeholder at the client that just had an email said, we really need X? And these people are kind of like trying to, you know, placate them, right? So that really gets to the second thing, which is, as a product team, do you have direct access to customers, or is your access being limited, right? And if all the information you're getting is through proxies, through sales, right, or through other key stakeholders in the company, it's like, oh, I just know what big client X needs, you know, my gut, I know that industry, I know what they need, you know, those are all proxies. And that's where you run the risk. If you think about it from a risk, we all know that like over 80% of new product sale, 90%, depending on the study you look at, that's where the risk comes in. When you assume, you make the assumption that, oh, I know they really need feature X. And if we build feature X, it's going to create value for them. Well, the part of the problem is, were you clear on what problem feature X was supposed to solve for them? Mm-hmm. And was that really a problem? And was it an important problem that they didn't already have a solution to? You know, rarely, you know, when products fail, it's not often execution. It's not because the code was bad or the UX was bad. It's because you just didn't really understand the problem you were trying to solve. You didn't solve it. You just built something. It's like, again, ready, fire, aim, right? So that's part of it too is, you know, and I understand sometimes you're in a company and you're like, yeah, I want to go talk to client X, and the sales team's like, whoa, you can't go talk to them. We're up for renewal. I don't want you putting your foot in your mouth and messing this up, right?
Yeah.
And so that's where, you know, and I know that's real, right? Not all companies are like that. Some companies are more open to talking to clients, but sometimes there are people that are trying to block or protect client access so we don't bug them too much, right? Mm-hmm. But the flip side is, if you're not talking to clients, you don't really can't do that discovery to understand the problems, right? That's why one of the top tactics is, you know, and I've seen companies where like legal or so-and-so will just actively block you from people from accessing them, is you flip it on your head and say, okay, if you're going to just block us from having carte blanche access, let's create some whitelist. Let's create a customer advisory panel, you know, or, you know, council. And these are customers that have opted in to say it's okay for us to ping them and get their feedback. You know, so you kind of like, you know, if you're getting blacklisted, if the whole thing's getting blacklisted, you try to create a whitelist of people you can go to, right? So that's why the customer advisory council is one of the top techniques in enterprise companies for PMs to have that pre-approved channel to get that customer feedback. That's the other reason private betas are such a good way to go too. If you get in a private beta, well, now it's like, well, yeah, of course I got to talk to them so we can talk about the beta and make sure it's meeting their needs and all that jazz, right? So That's a good best practice too, is before you do GA of a new product, you do a private beta so you can really get in there and make sure that, you know, before it's fully baked, it's meeting people's needs.
Mm-hmm. No, I love, yeah, I really love kind of some of those recommendations in terms of making sure that you're showcasing that failure. And I think in my experience, when I've worked for companies that perhaps aren't as product led, if you can really surface it, talk about it in a meaningful way and have a constructive conversation, that can help change some folks' minds. And I think some other really good kind of tactics that you mentioned, again, if you just don't have access to it, because I speak with a lot of product folks that just simply don't, and they don't feel like they're empowered to even be able to.
Right.
Cabs.
When you, and you go back to who, this really falls more on product leadership, not the individual product manager to try to solve this problem, right? It's like product leadership needs to have frank discussions with the head of sales and figure some of this, and the CEO to figure some of this stuff out.
Yeah, definitely. It needs, it can't just be the PM alone. And I think that's where they can nudge it when they're in one-on-ones with their leaders.
Exactly.
Hey, should we start thinking about it differently like this?
Yeah.
One thing I'd love to pick your brain on a little bit more in terms of a tactic, but I also know that enterprise customers and product folks working within them struggle it, is applying the concept of MVPs and minimum viable product.
Yes.
To try and help improve the chance and the likelihood of it being successful. But
right,
a lot of the conversations I have, folks still kind of struggle with getting that going. So what would be, I guess, what is your take on, I guess, larger enterprise, perhaps B2B type companies applying this model?
Yeah. And that's, you know, whether it's B2C or B2B, in our product world, there's probably no single term that's more debated or divisive than MVP, right?
Yeah.
Just to be clear, just kind of category. It's in its own category of people don't agree on what this is. And,
why did
you know, you know that? Well, I'll tell you, it's bad because some people are like, I stopped using the term MVP. You know, and then other people, they invent other terms like minimal lovable product, minimal sellable product, minimal marketable feature. Yeah. You know, it's bad when people are stopping to use the term or creating alternative terms. I don't think, honestly, either of those tactics helps make things better. Now you just got even more confusing, you know, list of things that you can do. But to your answer your question, I mean, it's something every company struggles with. Most companies, not every, most do. Some really get it and they apply it and they use it to their advantage. But, you know, the idea of minimum viable product is, hey, let's not overscope things until we confirm we're heading in the right direction. It's just, I mean, it makes a lot of sense from a risk management standpoint. It's like, hey, before we go and invest all these engineering resources and, it's like in the old days of waterfall, these agile is well known these days in practice. So, you know, significantly, but in the old days, you'd write some big PRD or MRD, right? Give it to a bunch of engineers. They'd go off into a cave for 24 months and code and come out and launch the product they'd worked on to the world. And then often it wouldn't do well. Like that's a risky way to do it. Lisa, the longer you go coding, building, prototyping before you get customer contact and feedback, that's where you're incurring the risk. If you just think about it, where does the risk come in? The risk comes in if we don't truly understand customer problems. The risk comes in when we just start building, we assume what we're building is right. Like if you build it, they will come. Mm-hmm. That's where the risk comes in, right? So, you know, but where the main reason MVP, there's two big interpretations, two different interpretations. And I see both. And it's especially bad enterprise companies. So actually, I gave a talk recently just on MVP, right, just to talk about this issue. And I kind of created this spectrum of, and I asked people, I surveyed the audience real time, I pull them, I'm like, okay, is this an MVP? And I work my way up the spectrum from a landing page, which some people think is, but most people don't, all the way up to, okay, what about a set of mockups? What about a prototype? What about like a private beta? What about a publicly available GA code, right? And, you know, once you get to kind of GA code, most people are like, yeah, that's an MVP. And the two camps, it's just funny because the hardcore camp, the conservative hardcore MVP camp is like, Dan, how can a landing page be an MVP? There's no our mockups. They can't be an MVP. Don't you know what the P stands for? It stands for product. Those are not products. You can't actually use them. So no, they cannot be an MVP. And then at the other end of the spectrum are the more laid back liberal people. Hey man, why you got to be so judgmental? Anything you learn from, anything you can test a hypothesis from is an MVP, you know? And so those are the people that embrace the lower end of the spectrum where like, hey, you know, landing page or, you know, mockups or prototypes can be right. And so I see both sides. One is like, you know, if you have a lower bar of, hey, anything you could learn from is an MVP, then that's one thing. But the hardcore people are like, no, if it's not a real product, it's not working code, it's not a P, it's not a product, right? And honestly, those two groups are never going to agree. They're just never going to agree. And so that's why I propose using the word like MVP test or MVP experiment or MVP prototype, right? So we can be like, okay, let's reserve MVP for the actual working product that the hardcore people are going to insist on. And let's use like MVP prototype for the mockups or prototype that we're going to do. And we can use the word MVP test or experiment for some of these even lower things like an ad, you know, like if you're doing an ad test or a landing page test, right? So that's kind of, that's part of it. But regardless, so that's one misinterpretation. But then the other thing that happens that you kind of alluded to is, and it's ironic, one of the top mistakes people make with MVPs is, it's ironic because the whole point of an MVP is to not overscope whatever milestone you're planning, and yet people overscope their MVPs all the time. And the way it works is, you know, and I have a visual of this where it's like proposing a roadmap and saying, here's what's going to be in the next version. And there are some features that we've agreed, we recommend deferring beyond the first version so we can get the first version out quicker rather than later. And inevitably, someone in the company is like, sees that, some stakeholder goes, wait a minute, you're going to have that key feature in there? Oh my gosh, I think it's going to be horrible. We're going to be the laughingstock of the industry. Big client X is going to throw a hissy fit. Usually there's a lot of noise and hand waving and not a lot of data. And now the poor product team's like, okay, we've got the situation where this big stakeholder really wants that feature in there. They're usually not empowered to say no. And then you put that feature in. But what nobody talked about is, well, by adding that feature, you just delayed your MVP launch by 4 weeks, 6 weeks, 8 weeks, who knows, right?
Yeah.
And so in those situations, if it stopped there, it'd be fine. And I get it, but then some other stakeholder comes in about some other feature. Next thing you know, you're adding all the features back in. You're doing the waterfall kitchen sink MVP all over again. You never launch it, you know, or it takes a long time to launch. By then, because you launched it late, you didn't realize you didn't build what people wanted too late, so you can't adapt or iterate. By the way, you've locked in your code base now, right? I mean, the second you start coding, you are creating constraints that are going to limit your ability or reduce your efficiency going forward, right? So that's why I personally like to hold off coding as long as possible. I'd like to validate with prototypes and iterate as much as I can so that when we do go to code, we have a high degree of confidence that what we're about to code is going to actually create customer value, right? But the reason those people, you know, just to put ourselves in their shoes for a second and be empathetic, they're worried. The reason they're pushing for these extra features is they're worried that the MVP is going to be inadequate. Oh my gosh. I just think, you know what? More features, the better. The more features you put under the chance, the better the chance that something's going to like resonate with a customer.
Mm-hmm.
And it reminds me of like throwing spaghetti at the wall. It's like, hey, the more spaghetti we throw at the wall, the higher the chance that something's going to stick. That is not a very scientific way to do product management or product development, right? But I understand that kind of human temptation to be like, oh, it's not good enough. We just need to do more. But by following, you know, the practices in my book and what other thought leaders say, you can really build a case where like, no, we actually think this should be adequate for MVP. Because we're not really saying we're never going to build that feature. The problem is when you get in these debates with the stakeholders, they act like you're saying, hey, you're never going to build my feature. But what we're just saying is, no, can we just fast follow that feature and launch it a month later or 2 months later? Is that such a big deal? Like, you know, but that's not how the conversation gets framed, right? It gets framed as, oh my gosh, I need this thing. And it's a political battle. And so.
Yeah. And then scope creep. And then it goes on for quarters.
Yeah. Yeah.
Dan, one challenge that I certainly faced earlier in my career and what I see a lot of product makers and product managers face as well is the cycle of creating an MVP, launching it, and never coming back to it.
Yes, totally.
Now, you probably talk about this a lot, but I'd love your thoughts on why that happens. Is it a good or a bad thing? Perhaps.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that dynamic, I see what you see in a lot of companies and product teams will tell me, hey, this sounds great, but we are never given time or permission to go back and iterate that MVP. So if you know that, it reminds me of like the Charlie Brown cartoon where Lucy's always got the football and he's like, yeah, come kick the football, Charlie Brown. And she always pulls it away. It's like, no, this time I'm not gonna. Like, it's like Groundhog Day, right? And every single time you get told, oh, yeah, yeah, you'll get to work on version 0.1. Don't worry. And then you never do. And, you know, so if you know that, then that's yet another reason to jam more in your MVP, because you know you're never going to come back and get the iterator, right? So that makes that dynamic contributes to overscoping of MVPs from product teams just saying like, gosh, we're never going to get back. Let's just get this feature in because we're never going to give permission to work on this. Now, the core issue is actually really one of the thorniest issues in the product world. Like, let's assume for a sec, you know, like when companies call me to do private training workshops, they're pretty much done with their agile transformation or well along in their agile transformation, right? And now they're realizing, okay, we've got the agile apparatus working, but how do we make sure we're creating, what we're asking to build in the agile process is going to create customer value. And then they realize PM is important and they hire up PMs and they try to upskill their PMs. And then usually the UX transformation comes slightly staggered after that. They realize, okay, we need good UX, right? But basically, you know, going back to the issue here, let's assume for a moment, you've like crushed your agile transformation. You've crushed your PM transformation, right? You've crushed your UX transformation and you've crushed your analytics. You are a machine, right? Basically. And, you know, whatever you put into your roadmap, you're going to execute well on. That really highlights the last remaining problem, which I think is the thorniest that, or even the most advanced product organizations, the most talented ones, wrestle with, which is what I call high-level product planning. And what that means is how do we plan and commit resources like to our roadmap on a quarterly, whatever, six-month basis? And unfortunately, what happens there is most product roadmaps are overscoped from the beginning. Like, there's no one did a good job of scoping the roadmap to make sure that what we're putting down for next quarter, that should add up, you know? And it's different, right? When you're doing a scrum and doing story points, you kind of get a sense of, okay, our velocity is 30 and we can do this. There's, you know, building a similar process and mindset, but at the quarterly planning level is often missing in companies, you know, basically where the way it works is all the stakeholders, you know, put in their requests for features. The head of product kind of tries to prioritize them some. He or she looks over at the head of engineering and he or she says, hey, do you think we can get this all done in the quarter? They kind of go, yeah, I think we can do it, right? That is a far cry. You know, the way to think about it is like, what confidence would they put in that we can deliver all that stuff, right? And so I think most roadmaps start out oversized, okay? And how would you solve that? Well, I've seen companies solve it where what you do is you estimate, and it's a whole different estimation skill because now you need to talk about like people weeks or people months of effort, not story points. It's, you know, I've actually seen people try to use story points. Yeah, this is going to take 2,000 story points. I'm like, no, story points is the wrong unit to use for quarterly planning. You need to be using like engineer weeks, engineer sprints, engineer months, something like that. But just some high-level pass, a sanity check. Does this even make sense, right? And part of it is, you know, as I always like to give empathy to our friends in engineering, the fidelity of their estimates is kind of proportional to the fidelity of the spec that we give them. If we just give them like, hey, here's a sentence for what we're thinking of building. Can you give me an estimate, engineering, please? If I was the engineer, I'd give a wide range of uncertainty, right? Because I don't, you know, you haven't given me much info. If in contrast, you gave me like, you know, a thought out product doc, definition doc, and a set of user stories and a set of mockups, well, now I can kind of give you more accurate, right? But we don't have time to design the whole thing in the planning phase. So you've got to build this muscle up of how do we do like high level rough planning so we can right size our roadmap going into the quarter. That's the first problem I see. Then the next problem is, that let's assume for a second you start the quarter with a balanced roadmap that's been right-sized for your resources, okay? The next problem that comes in, well, hopefully you've accounted for like tech debt and maintenance and, you know, live site issues. If you act like 100% of your pie can go to new feature development, you're fooling yourself, right? So part of that right-sizing is not only scoping the features, but making sure, hey, you know, we need to devote 10-15% of the pie to maintenance and live site issues and bug fixes, right? Let's assume that's all good. Then the problem is the clock starts ticking on the quarter. And in week 1, 2, or 3, that's when some key stakeholder or some key client comes in and says, I really need this feature X. That's not in your roadmap, right? And what most companies do is they can't say no. And so they just say, okay, cool. Can you work it in? Yeah, I think we can work it in. Or I think we can work it in. There's no way you can work it in because you're already 100%. But nobody was being real. No one was being realistic. And so they jammed this new feature in. Well, as I like to remind people, the pie is only 100%. So you jam that feature in, you silently, unwittingly, something else is going to get pushed out. By the end of the quarter, some other feature is going to get pushed. No one admitted it. No one did the analysis to figure it out, but that's what's going to happen, right? The other thing is surprises can come up. But anyway, I call those meteorites. They come in, they just... You have this nice plan. They come in, they go, you know, they make an impact crater on your plan. And the problem is most organizations, they just say yes to all those meteorites and they don't do any trade-offs. You know, the reality is, yeah, we can accommodate that meteorite, but what other, you know, 20 engineer week feature do you want to bump to make room for that? Instead of just kind of playing this yes game where we're all acting like we can do it all and not really acknowledging it, right?
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think one thing I just wanted to kind of touch on that really resonated with me is developing that muscle of roadmapping, developing that rigor of being able to have those conversations and those trade-offs. Because I think what a lot of teams fall into the habit of is they change it every time they approach quarterly planning. And it's hard to get into that understanding. See, yeah. How do you approach it together? Do you see that as well? Like,
I think most teams do not have a process at all. It's not that the process is changing. They just do not have a process. Right. And it's sad they actually don't even have a roadmap. So when you don't have, and that's why I'm a big fan of like simple one-page artifacts to get everybody on the same page. When you don't have a simple one-page roadmap that everybody could look at and say, here's what's in scope for the quarter. And if it's not on here, it's out of scope for the quarter. Then of course you get kind of chaos. And I thought this feature was in. Oh, I thought this was in. Well, I talked to sales and they said, we really need this. And I thought, you know, it devolves into kind of like verbal tribal lore. Like it's like, how, is there any one record of what we're doing or not? Like, it's just like verbal conversations that change, you know what I mean? So it's like, how do we actually have these documents? Because yes, things are going to change. No company's like, sorry, that's our roadmap, we can't change it. But most companies err on the side of allowing too much change. But the most important thing is they don't do any trade-offs when things change. Just add things to the, so you already started over 100% resource of your roadmap, then you add the meteorites, the other thing I like to call it shiny object syndrome, you know, mm-hmm. In the middle of the quarter, it's like, ooh, ChatGPT came out. What's our AI strategy? We don't have anything on the roadmap. You better add some AI stuff on the roadmap. You know, which by the way, that solution speak, that's a solution. There was not a single customer problem mentioned in there, but you know, that's what happens. And so instead, you want to kind of have a rationalized roadmap where you know the amount of effort for each of these items so that when things come up, you can dynamically make trade-offs.
Right. Yeah, I was just going to touch on that as one of our last questions, because our listeners love things that they can walk away with right now. They might be listening to the desk, hopefully. So what would you include on that one pager for a roadmap? What are some of those things you would look for? So you mentioned amount of effort, the item.
Sure. Yeah. Well, the first thing is, so it should fit on one page. Like a lot of times in my workshops, I'd be like, what's a roadmap? And because sometimes I'll go into a company and I'm like, do you have a roadmap? They go, yeah. And they pull up an Excel spreadsheet of a list of items. I'm like, that's not a roadmap, you know? Or they'll be like, yeah, we have a Jira backlog. I'm like, that's a backlog. That's why we call that a backlog. It's not a roadmap. So what, if you just take a step back and say, what is a roadmap? For me, a roadmap is a single page. It's really important that it fit on one page. If it takes more than one page, you're not being high level enough. It needs to be high level, right? I've seen people try to jam in like 8-point font, all this stuff on a page. I'm like, that's not, you know? So one page visual representation of what we plan to build in the order that we plan to build it, maybe with some explicit timeframes, maybe not, right? So for a quarter, let's say, and part of it is you got to pick planning horizon, right? So you say, okay, we're going to do Q4 roadmap, right? October, November, December, 2023. It's for those 3 months. Cool. The next thing you need to do is have swim lanes, right? How you, or what are the themes that you're organizing what you're working on? One of the top mistakes I see people make is those themes are solution space. You know, it's like, oh, it's our, it's like integration, or it's reg, or it's platform, or it's security. You know, those belong in the boxes in the roadmap, not as the themes. The theme should be either customer problems. Hey, we're trying to improve reliability, or we're trying to increase processing speed, or we're trying to save them money, or whatever it is, right? Improve productivity. It should be grounded in customer problems, or like kind of business KPIs that we're trying to improve. Hey, we're trying to increase adoption, we're trying to improve conversion, we're trying to improve retention, something like that. We're trying to upsell. Those are the valid things for swim lanes, for your themes of your roadmap. And then you put the functionality in boxes in the swim lanes, you know, by kind of, you know, over time when you think you can do them. And that's where the right sizing for the effort comes in. You need to know like how many people units is it going to take, how many people weeks or months is it going to take, and how many kind of rough calendar months so that you can look at it. And, you know, sometimes when I drive people this exercise, they end up like stacking like 6 or 7 features right away in the roadmap. And then I look at it and go, is it realistic that your teams, how many product teams do you have? Well, we only have three teams. I'm like, can they work on six or seven things at a time? So you need to then rationalize the plan and say, oh, well, they can only do three at a time. So let's spread it out. You know what I mean? You kind of just take a little high level realistic approach of how many do we think we can really work on at a time? How long do we think each one's going to take? And you make sure the total number of, you know, people months adds up to the number of people, and you know, it's 3 months for a quarter and you have 10 people, right? So then, okay, we have 300 people months of effort that we can use, right? So let's do some high level math and make sure we're not biting off 400 people months of effort in our roadmap, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's awesome reminder for the group. And I think we touched on it earlier, but you spoke about how teams approach sprint planning and refinement and being able to scale that to road mapping. And I think there's so many lessons that a PM can actually bring from their day-to-day working with teams into product leadership when you think about road mapping or structuring it like that as well. So that's awesome. We're on time now. I want to thank you so much for joining us today, Dan. We covered a lot of ground. Thanks a lot for spending the time with us today, Dan.
Yeah, my pleasure, Adam. Great talking with you.
Got two more questions for you. Where can folks find you?
The main place they can find me is my website, dan-olsen.com. And I have links there to my YouTube channel, which is youtube.com/danolsen. The meetup that I mentioned briefly earlier. So I've been over for over 9.5 years now. I've been running this monthly speaker series product community that's over 12,000 people. So if you go to meetup.com/lean-product, you can join that group for free. And again, each month we bring in a top speaker. And then, you know, on LinkedIn, I'm on LinkedIn as well.
Brilliant. Awesome. And one final one for you. How can listeners help you? So you do a lot of talks, you create a lot of awesome content. Is there anything our listeners can help you with?
Yeah, I mean, part of how I got to where I am today is by giving talks to product people and hearing what questions they had and what challenges they were facing. So that's why I'm excited to be in industry and talk to a bunch of people and mind the product, so I can get that feedback of like, what are the real challenges, or as they try to implement my advice, what challenges they were into. And I've gotten into very detailed conversations about Jira and how to story point with people. I'm like, that's a real concern of how to do it, right? So just kind of, hitting me up with questions that they have about any of the content that I've got, you know, checking out the videos. You can leave comments on the videos. That's always a good feedback mechanism as well.
Awesome. All right. Well, thanks for listening, everyone. And thanks for being on the podcast today, Dan.
Yeah, thanks, Adam.